History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to ask a few questions and, more importantly, to listen intently and patiently as memories from long ago take on fresh meaning in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, what we find is that not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we become truly inspired by what we hear from these members of our greatest generation. I had planned this weekend to introduce you to a Purple Heart recipient in Colorado, and in the weeks ahead, a couple of ex-prisoners of war. But I decided to dedicate today's episode to a World War II veteran whose story, whose life, whose passion may have inspired more people around the world than any other member of that greatest generation. That would be very hard to calculate, and it's certainly not a competition. They all inspire me in different ways, but Louis Zamperini has been on my mind the last couple weeks. Many of you know that name, and if not the name, you certainly know the book Unbroken by Laura Hillenbrand or the two major motion pictures that have followed. Louis was on my mind on Easter Sunday when I happened to be in Torrance, California, where the Olympian first became a track star. The Torrance Tornado, they called him. I drove down Zamperini Way and saw the Torrance Airport, itself now known as Louis Zamperini Field. From Torrance, I went to the University of Southern California to pick up our daughter, who's studying there, her dorm right across the street from the Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum, where Louis once raced for the Trojans. Even in church that Easter Sunday, there were connections and reflections of this legendary Olympian turned prisoner of war. But the last nudge that convinced me I needed to revisit Louis' story this week was when photos started showing up on social media, marking the 80th anniversary of a mission that nearly ended his life. Maybe you saw one of those photos this week, Zamperini peering through a hole in the side of his B-24 that the enemy put there 80 years ago over the Pacific island of Nauru. So I finally decided I should take the hint and share Louis' story with you today. Some of you listening have heard some of it before, but most of you probably haven't. Ideally, I like to visit with the veterans you hear on Hometown Heroes in their homes, where they're most comfortable. But when I had the chance to interview Louis back in 2011 over the phone, I couldn't pass that up. And hearing him tell the story, 94 years old at the time, but as sharp as any 30-year-old, is something that never gets old for me. Let's start with how he earned that nickname that would follow him forever, Lucky Louis.
I just moved into Long Beach from Olean, New York, from the cold climate to the warm climate, and a kid challenged me to a race. And he beat me, and he ran across the street and was hit by a car and mangled. So that was my first loss. And I had another race a couple of years later in Torrance when we moved there, and this kid challenged me to a race across the street, and I lost that one, and he was hit by a car. So, you know, I was lucky I wasn't fast.
Yeah, I guess that's a situation where it's good not to be the fastest. But soon you would be the fastest. They started calling you Zamp the Champ around Southern California. You ended up at USC, and in 1936, you made the U.S. Olympic team.
Well, first of all, to make the Olympics, I'm running against the world record holder in the 5,000 meters and the 2 mile, mm-hmm. especially the 2 mile, and we came in a dead heat, so that was a big thrill. That put me on the team, and of course, during the Depression, we used to forage for food. We were so hungry, and there was unemployment was bad. And but I got aboard a ship, and I'm stunned. I can't believe the food they kept bringing to the table. I mean, they just kept bringing stuff. And so my gold medal was to see how much I could eat before I got to Berlin. I gained 14 pounds, and that was too much.
14 pounds on one little cruise across the Atlantic.
Yeah, and then when I got to Berlin, I thought, I'm going to work it off. But then they have this beautiful village. They had a semicircle, two-story building, and each door was a door to every nation's cuisine. Mm-hmm. So I had to try them all.
Well, of course.
Yeah, of course. So I couldn't keep up the pace in the 5,000 meters. So I'm way behind, 50 yards behind the leading pack. I'm in the second pack of guys. But in the last lap, I thought, oh, man, if But my brother always told me, he said, he was a coach, he said, everybody's tired, the third lap of the mile. But think of it this way, just open up and run your guts out, because isn't 1 minute of pain worth a lifetime of glory? So I sprinted the whole last lap, and of course it brought the grandstand up. I see a runner gaining 50 yards on the leader,
mm-hmm.
and I came down the home stretch with the first pack, but I only got eighth place. But then it was in the papers that I ran the last lap in a blistering 56 seconds, which is unheard of. And then as a result of that, I got Goebbels, I guess it was, came over from the officers. German officers were between Hitler and the American team.
Right.
And he said, Hitler wants to see you. I said, hey, I didn't win a gold. He said, well, he wants to see you. I went over and he just said, the boy with the fast finish, a light handshake, and that was it. I guess it was exciting to see someone gain 50 yards, even though I didn't win anything.
Well, it sounds exciting to me, and if I had been announcing that race, I think I would have been going crazy watching you sprint past him.
And by the way, Jesse Owens and Mac Robinson, they were my roommates in the village. Great guys, both of them, and Jesse Owens especially, he was a prince.
With the story of Jesse Owens and that Olympics and the snub by Adolf Hitler, was that something that you were aware of that had an impact
on
you at
Jesse
the time?
Well, Jesse Owens was, as I say, people loved Jesse Owens, even though they never met him, because nothing got him down. If people made a racial remark, he'd just say, hey, it's not my problem, it's their problem. And so as they came in, when Hitler came in the stadium, they were, by orders, had to stand up and cheer him. But when Jesse Owens came in, he got twice the ovation that Hitler got. And because of that, I think Hitler hated blacks, and especially Jesse Owens.
Well, I certainly understand that. I guess you ran that last lap at about Jesse Owens' sprint speed, too.
Yeah, I wish.
This is before, obviously, no one at that point, certainly from the West, had any idea of how evil Hitler really was and the things that he had planned, the things that he would carry out. What was your sense at the time of meeting this dictator?
Well, I think because the entire nation was military, we knew something was going on, and we figured he'd probably take over some country in Europe, and his plans were to take over the world. And I think we waited too long. Nobody wants to get involved, you know, the money and a war. Until it's too late, then you have to get involved, and then you got a real problem. Same thing happened with Japan. They were building an empire across the Pacific. Everybody knew, every school kid was taught in history class that they're moving fast all over east. And they've already come as far as the Marshall and Gilbert Islands. What's the next island? The next island would be Hawaii. And about 7 months before Hawaii was hit, they put out a bombing notice in four languages, which we brought back copies of that, warning people what to do in case of a bombing attack. Well, who else could bomb Hawaii but Japan?
Makes
Nobody
sense
else.
To me.
So it's kind of a ridiculous thing, and people got suspicious that the people in high office knew something, and they didn't let the public know.
We're talking to Louis Zamperini, and he lives in Southern California. Back in 1936, he was in Berlin for the Olympics with the American Olympic team, finished eighth in the 5,000 meters. And then, of course, you don't go home immediately after the race. And there are a lot of elements of your story, Louis, that are really incredible and hard to believe. But this one's right up there with them. You got a very unique souvenir after you were done running in Berlin. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, they had what they call beer automats, and the smallest beer they served in Germany was about a liter. <You know? laughs> So we put down a couple of beers, and walking down the street, and I was standing in front of the chancellery, and I thought, what a beautiful building with these groins and pillars. And then I noticed all the beautiful flags flying from the top of the building. Those were long satin-like flags. You could never get near them. Then I saw a smaller flag down on the front wall, and I saw the guards walking back and forth. I timed them, and I had plenty of time to get across the street, get that flag, and get away. But when I got there, the flag was higher than I had anticipated. And then the guards did reach the corner. When they turned around and saw me, they began to scream in German, and I knew they were mad. But I jumped up, clutched the flag in my hand, and ripped it from the pole. And then I did what I do best, and that's run. And then I heard a crack like a rifle shot, and the word halt was saying, well, I didn't need an interpreter for that. And so I halted, and they came up, and they spun me around rather rudely until they saw the American and Olympic flag on my coat pocket. And then they start talking to each other, and then the one officer who spoke very poor English, but I could understand him. He said, "But why did you tear down the swastika, you know?" And I said, "Well, I just wanted to take it home to America with me to always remind me of the wonderful time I had in your country." Well, he couldn't refuse, so he went inside, talked to von Fritz, because I remember when he came out, I remember the word Fritz.
Mm-hmm.
And he was told to let me have the flag, so I still have it.
You still have that flag?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been, people come in and photograph it all the time, and it's been on a lot of TV shows.
Yeah, you've been a very popular guy lately, and I'm thrilled about that. 75 years you've had that flag now. That's hard to believe. And you made it back to the States, of course, after that. And I know that you enlisted in, you were a cadet in the Army Air Corps initially, then you were drafted into the Army. But what happened after that? How did you end up back in the Army Air Corps?
Well, first of all, I trained not for Berlin. I was aiming for the 1940 Tokyo Olympics. Well, of course, we were all in great shape. All the Olympians were looking forward to that Olympics in Japan. And then it was canceled because Japan was at war all over the East, and then Norway was supposed to pick it up, but then the war in Europe, they couldn't do that. So it was a heartbreaker. It was pretty hard to take when you train 4 years for one event. But then when Pearl Harbor was hit, it was a different story. Everybody forgot, and the athletes forgot about being athletes. They wanted to get in to get it over with as soon as possible. And so most guys that I know of just volunteered. We didn't wait for a draft. And I ended up in the Air Corps.
And you would end up on a B-24 crew?
Yeah, we were up in Oneida, Washington, Winnetka, Washington, waiting for our planes to come in, and we were hoping for B-17s because the B-24 was known at that time as the Flying Coffin. So, then in comes all these B-24s, and our hearts just sunk. And, of course, if you read the book, Unbroken, you'll realize how many B-24s, more were lost in training than combat.
Right. And the B-24, another nickname it has, the Flying Anvil. I don't know what's more intimidating, the Flying Anvil or the Flying Coffin.
Well, the plane did the job. It carried twice the bomb load of the B-17, and it was about 30 miles an hour faster. And so in the Pacific, they brought back all the B-17s because they couldn't fly to these far-off islands. And so we all had B-24s. Now, we took 26 of these B-24s and flew from Midway to Wake Island, bombed it, and flew back. And no plane in the world could do that at that time but a B-24. And then our missions were like, we'd have to fly like 1 or 2 days to our mission. In Europe, they'd get to the target in an hour or two.
That first mission that you had, or I guess not the first mission, you talked about bombing Wake Island. But I understand there was a mission not too long later where your B-24 got shot up pretty good.
Yeah, this was the Nauru raid. Now, this was the greatest concentration of nitrate in the world, bird droppings over millions of years. And the Japanese needed that for fertilizer and making bombs. And so they had it well fortified. We sent 26 bombers over, and we were in the lead group. And our job is to knock out the ACAC and stuff like that.
Right.
But by going over first, we got the worst of it. And my final bomb hit their supply depot, which smoke shot in the air about 8,000 feet. And all their fuel was burned up. And because of that, I think out of 9 Zeros that took off, 3 of them attacked us and wouldn't let us go. And I think the reason they were so persistently after us is because they knew that our bombs blew up their fuel supply. And so we had a running battle for several minutes, and the Japanese Zeros came in so close they couldn't miss us. And also, they were in so close we couldn't miss them. So we finally shot down all 3 Zeros, but not before taking on 5 cannon holes in the plane.
Oof.
Right tail shot off. A hydraulic tank was blasted, so we had no power for the flaps and everything else. We had to use a crank and crank them down. And we had 7 guys laid out. 1 died. But the 4 officers, the navigator, pilot, co-pilot, myself, we were untouched. But I pulled 1 guy off of the catwalk. Now, the bomb bay doors wouldn't close because the hydraulic tank was blowing up.
Right.
And so I walked back there, and I found the radio man on the catwalk, which is about 14 inches wide, and he was just laying there with one leg hanging out 8,000 feet above the ocean.
Ooh.
And he just looked up at me, and I pulled him back up on the flight deck, and I'm underneath the upper turret now. And the upper turret, his foot was level with my head. I gave Brooks a shot of morphine, and then he was trying to say something. I couldn't understand, and I bent over. Just as I bent over to listen to him, I heard a loud crack, and a 20-millimeter went through the radio compartment and shattered the upper turret gunner's leg and foot.
Oh.
But if I hadn't bent over, it would have hit me right in the head.
Wow.
So that was really, when I think about it, I just bent over to listen to him, and the blast went right where my head was and hit Pillsbury in the foot and his leg.
Talk about a close call. Holy moly.
My service in Pacific was one close call after another.
It sure sounds like it. And what amazes me about that mission, you came down in that B-24, and you're the bombardier, and you're explaining what you did to try to help your crewmate there. You guys actually landed that plane with 600 bullet holes in it?
Well, what happened, they had a submarine, I believe it was called the Drum, 20 miles on course towards our island. But with a running battle with those three Zeros, we passed that point. We're supposed to land on the water, and the submarine will pick us up. But we're way past that point, and now the four motors are humming pretty good, so but the rest of the plane was a mess. But we had it, so we decided to take a chance and get it back to Funafuti. The plane was so badly shot up, the pilot and co-pilot had both their hands and their knees on the yoke or the steering wheel to keep the plane from stalling because of all the damage. And we had 600 fragmentation of bullet holes in the plane, plus 5 cannon holes. And we got back, and the plane kept porpoising. So we had to come in low and hot. And this is a short runway, and you go right off the end of the runway, and we had no brakes. And so I had two parachutes tied to the waist, one in each window, and when we landed, I was going to deploy those chutes and stop the plane. And that's the first time it was ever supposed to be tried. But later, somebody else did it, and it does work. And then they used that for space shuttle and all that stuff. But anyway, we got back, and we came in low and hot. And when we hit the runway, I thought, man, we're going to go off the end. But just as we touched down, the plane ground looped to the left. Well, what happened, one of those 20-millimeter shells had gone through the front of the airplane into the wing between the number one and number two motor and actually penetrated the tire. So thank God the tire was flat because it caused us to ground loop. And now we're ground loop off of the runway with four motors going, and there's a bomber coming towards us with four motors going. This is really weird. And then the co-pilot knew we had no brakes, but he inadvertently pushed the brakes, and there was enough fluid in the brake well to cause it to lock momentarily, and that caused us to ground loop to the right. And so if he hadn't done that, we'd have gone straight into the other bomber, and both planes would have blown up.
Sure sounds like somebody was looking out for you that day.
That's what somebody said. You know, somebody up there loves you. I said, well, I'm glad somebody does.
Well, you can throw quite a few million people in that camp, a number that grows every time somebody reads Unbroken or Louis Zamperini's autobiography, The Devil at My Heels. That miraculous mission over Nauru was 80 years ago this week. It came so close to ending his life at so many points of that wild ride in a B-24, but it was nowhere near the worst of what he endured in World War II. We'll explore more of Louis Zamperini's incredible story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.